ever been one of those people that held the signs, worked on a road crew, held one of those signs that said, you know, go slow or stop or something like that? Have you seen those guys out there? I think there's one member of our kahila that have done that. And working on a road crew, I remember when I was a kid, one of my little matchbox cars was a dump truck that the back actually really did tip up, and I could put things in there and then drive it around and dump it out. Dreaming of being a builder. Dreaming of being putting things together, you know, building. I built forts in my backyard. My dad loved to garden, and he would drive around in his 1970-something Toyota Corolla hatchback that he bought from his dad, and collect bags of leaves, and he'd throw those bags of leaves in the back of his Corolla and take them home and dump them in his compost pile for his garden the following spring. And every year he'd let me take those leaves and build a fort out of them. It was so much fun. I enjoyed being a builder. Did you know that we are commanded in the Torah to be a construction worker of building roads? Did you know that the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim chapter 19, commands us to build roads? Have you ever thought about that? We are a road builder. We are a construction crew. We are the ones that get to go out and hold the sign, to direct traffic, to build the road, to make it wide and smooth. Well, let me tell you what I'm talking about. Joshua chapter 20 is about the cities of refuge. Now that the inheritance that the tribes of Israel are to gain and receive have been allotted to each tribe, in some cases they didn't like the inheritance that they received and went and took a different inheritance, for instance, the tribe of Dan, and Ephraim had some conflicts about their inheritance. Caleb asked for a specific inheritance, and Joshua was also given a specific inheritance that he requested. It's interesting that God allowed some people to ask him, and they received the very inheritance that they wanted. God, I want this. And God gave it to them. Right after this, we come to another discussion about the land, about the inheritance. But it's not, the word inheritance is not used in chapter 20 or 21. But these chapters are about the Levites. That tribe that was to be set aside, special to the Lord, they received a special inheritance, not land, not territory, not fields that they would own, but their inheritance was the Most High. But they had to have a place to live, right? And so in chapter 21 of Joshua, we are told that the tribes of Israel are to give cities to the Levites. Out of the inheritance that they've just received, they are to, on average, each tribe is to give the Levites four cities in their particular allotment, in their territory. Then the Levites are to take their cities and build what the text calls cities of refuge. Joshua chapter 20 says, "And the Lord said to Joshua, speak to the children of Israel, saying, give the cities of refuge that I spoke to you by the hand of Moses, that the manslayer that killeth any person through error and unaware may flee to. And they shall be for you as a refuge from the avenger of blood. And he will flee unto one of these cities, and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city, and will declare his cause in the ears of the elders of that city. And they will take him into the city, and give him a place, and that he may dwell among them. And if the avenger of blood pursue after him, then they shall not deliver the manslayer into his hand, because he killed his neighbor unaware and had not hated him previously. And he will dwell in that city until he stand before the congregation for judgment, unto the death of the high priest that will be in those days. Then the manslayer may return to his own city, to his own house, to the city that he had fled from." Then in verse 7 and following, it outlines the cities that they are to set aside. Three in the west side of the Jordan River, and three on the east. Verse 9 says, "These were the appointed cities for all the children of Israel, for the stranger that sojourns among them, that whoever kills any person through accident may flee to them and not die by the avenger of blood until he stands before the congregation." In this chapter, it takes an entire chapter to discuss these, what the text calls, cities of refuge. They're only mentioned in Scripture here in Joshua chapter 20 and in Numbers chapter 35 and in Deuteronomy chapter 19. There, not only were the tribes of Israel to give to the Levites cities where the Levites could dwell, there were 48 Levite cities total in the country. On average, four cities per tribe were given to the Levites. And then the Levites would take from those cities and establish safe places throughout the country. It began with, in the Torah, by talking about three cities. Now in the book of Joshua, it expands to six cities that were to be refuge places. Later, Jewish tradition tells us that all the Levite cities served as places of refuge. Here in Joshua, we're told that there would be six. Three on the east side of the Jordan, where the 2.5 tribes of Reuben and Manasseh were at, and then on the west side of the Jordan River, where the remaining 9.5 tribes were. The cities of refuge were equally spaced. If you look on a map where each of those cities were at, they're spread out evenly across the land of Israel. And we're told in Deuteronomy chapter 19 that there were to be roads that were prepared and built that went to the cities of refuge. We needed to make it easy for people to flee there. In fact, in Jewish tradition, we're told not only was there to be a road that would go to the city of refuge, it was also to be smooth. No obstacles on the road. They were to be, in our vernacular, they were to be the snow route. They were to be the road that was clear, the road that was clean. We're also told in Jewish tradition that those roads were designated to be twice the size as regular roads in Israel, to make sure that they were smooth, wide, had easy access to get to these cities of refuge. There were, according to Jewish tradition, signs that were to be posted along the road. Where did we get the idea of highway signs from? In our society, highway signs were invented, evidently, by the Israelis, the ancient Israelis, to mark the way to the cities of refuge. So that when you came to an intersection, say, of Highway 27 and 68, you would know which way to turn to go to the cities of refuge. So there would be people that their job would be to build these roads, to maintain these roads, to be a construction worker for the road to the city of refuge. Why would someone need to go to the city of refuge? In Torah culture, in the ancient home of the ancient Israelis, there were no prisons. Nowhere in the Torah do you read about prisons. That was an invention of a different time, a different culture. For crimes against people on certain levels, there were a series of punishments leading up to, in some cases, death. If you did certain things, if you murdered someone, for instance, you received the death penalty. There must be a fair trial in order to establish the death penalty. And by the way, there had to be two people that witnessed the murder in order for the death penalty to be given. In fact, for any punishment meted out by the court in ancient Israel, there always had to be two witnesses. You couldn't go on circumstantial evidence, and you could not convict someone on the testimony of only one person, because one person is not an adequate corroboration. And so it is today. Isn't it interesting that gossip is usually a tale told by a single person, from person to person to person? What if you killed someone accidentally? What if, for instance, you were coming down a ladder and you were carrying something in your hand, coming down a ladder, and you stumbled and your foot slipped off the rung of the ladder and you dropped the bucket of roof sealer? You know, those are heavy, by the way. Those are about 60 pounds each, I think, back from the day when I worked in construction and hardware, in a hardware store. You're carrying the bucket down the ladder. You stumble, you slip, your foot slides off the rung of the ladder. That's why you always have to wear good shoes. And that bucket falls on someone's head and they die. You are just guilty of killing someone. Accidentally, I'm sure, but you have just incurred guilt from killing someone. In that culture, there was the idea of just retribution. Retribution and punishment had to fit the crime. And so we are told in Torah that retribution must be even. It must be fair. If you knocked somebody's tooth out, you had to give them the monetary payment of what a tooth was worth. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, the Torah says. That's not as it is. We later hear the prophet Tevye say, oh, well, then in that way, the whole world will be toothless and blind. It's not quite the idea that we have in Torah. It's teaching that when you punish someone, the punishment must fit the crime. It must be fair. There were people that would that were designated, perhaps in each family or perhaps in the larger society, that their job was to go around and to mete out the punishment. They were called the Avenger of Blood, and they're mentioned here in this text. If I was coming down a ladder and I dropped a bucket of roof tar on someone's head and they died, I would be guilty of killing that person, and the Avenger of Blood would be allowed to come after me. They would be allowed to come after me to take my life because I had killed someone else. By the way, according to Jewish tradition, if I were going up the ladder carrying the bucket of roof sealer and it fell on somebody's head and killed them, I would be blameless. Because the idea is if I'm going up the ladder and drop it, it's not as negligent as if I were going down the ladder. Because if I was going down the ladder, I would see who was around me. There were, therefore, four levels of guilt when it came to killing someone. That is, if you committed murder and there were two witnesses, the punishment would be the death penalty. If you killed someone purposefully, but there were no witnesses, or the court could not decide if you did it intentionally or not, you would not be given the death penalty. The third case was if you accidentally killed somebody, you dropped that bucket on their head, and someone died, you could flee to the city of refuge and be safe from the avenger that would come after you. The fourth category, by the way, is if you accidentally killed someone and it was decided that it was completely blameless, would not, the Avenger of Blood would not be allowed to come after you. Four levels of in the rules regarding murder and death. Well, back to our story. So imagine someone comes running down this road, and I bet they're running fast. They're running down this road that is wide and smooth, that have signs marked this way to the city of refuge. And they come running up to the gate, and there they approach the Levites. Remember that every city of refuge is a Levitical city. The Levites are the ones in charge of the city. And they come to the Levites and they state their case. And it seems right to the Levites to give these people, this person, asylum in the city. And so they come in and they wait there in the city until the time of their trial. And we're told here in Joshua chapter 20 that they would remain in the city until the time of their trial. If they are found guilty, if there were witnesses, if they did this intentionally, well, then they would have the punishment meted out that the Torah instructed. But if they did not commit this murder intentionally, then they could remain and live in the city of refuge. There are three conditions that had to be met for someone to live in this city of refuge. They are, if the killing happened accidentally, that is, without, you know, weapons, without something that would be expected to lead to a death, if the death occurred accidentally. Secondly, is that if the person did not know that something like this would lead to someone's death, if they did not know, if they were not aware that death could result from this situation. And then thirdly, according to Joshua 20, the third condition that had to be met is that they did not previously hate the person who died. If it was known that this person had previously had conflict with person that was deceased, they would not be allowed to remain in the city of refuge. You could not hate, the perpetrator could not hate the person that was deceased. That, because that would raise questions of premeditation. This perhaps may have looked accidental, but perhaps this was premeditated in such a way to make it look blameless. And so you could not harbor hate in your heart toward the person that was deceased. Many years ago, I worked for a number of social service agencies as I was getting started in serving different congregations in the late 90s and in the first couple years after the year 2000. And there was a program in our community called Safe Place. There were places established around town, perhaps at a library, perhaps at a convenience store, at the fire station, where young people, minors, who were being bullied, who had run away, who were in some sort of precarious situation, they could go to the designated place, and there someone would help them, and ultimately the young person would come to the shelter that we operated and maintained. There would be a sign on the window of such a place that designated it as a safe place. Just a matter of last week, I was driving by a fire station in Lexington, and I saw the Safe Place sign. It doesn't say Safe Place. It's a little symbol that doesn't say Safe Place, but it marks, it's actually of two people hugging, is what it is, and a yellow sign. And there, someone could find security, hope, and help. And so they would come to our shelter. Perhaps they were homeless and needed help. Perhaps they were in some other condition. They could come and remain in our shelter for a period of hours before we had to, were required by law to contact their guardian or parents. But we were there to provide security for those that needed security. Not only are the roads to be established and built to the city of refuge, but there is also to be a willingness to provide a safe place. Again, each of the tribes had to donate out of their own inheritance. they had to donate places for the Levites to live so that the Levites could set up a safe place, could set up a place for people to run for their lives, literally. This just isn't playing, this just isn't base in a game of tag. This is life and this is death. It's interesting to me that Joshua chapter 20 and 21, in my mind, is really a commentary on Numbers chapter 35. In Numbers chapter 35, it discusses the Levitical cities, and then it discusses the Levites, the cities of refuge. It tells us in Numbers 35 that you are to give the Levite cities for them to dwell and to live. And then the Levites will establish these cities of refuge. In Joshua, it turns that order around. And it first talks about the cities of refuge before it even talks about the homes and cities for the Levites. To me, logically, Numbers chapter 35 puts it in the order that makes sense. You have to first give the Levites the cities so that they can establish the cities of refuge. Joshua turns it around and talks about the cities of refuge before it even talks about giving Levites the cities that they can use to establish these places. It puts the emphasis on justice. It puts the emphasis on security. Instead of following the logical order of what would happen in time, it puts the emphasis on God's heart. God's heart for justice. God's heart for mediating the random vendetta of vengeance of the people who would come after one to take their life. God wanted to mediate and curtail that custom. And so God created, out of his heart of justice, created safe places for people to flee so that they could live and be safe. As long as they dwelt there in that city, they would be safe from the people who were designated potentially to take their life. Baruch Haba is such a safe place. That is one of the reasons we exist. To provide a place to find rest, security, hope, help, aid, and comfort. To find peace, both with the Most High, but to establish a community so that we can help one another. That's the purpose of community. Sometimes I wonder when people call and ask, you know, I need groceries. I need help paying my rent. One of the questions I always want to ask is, what community are you a part of? What is your faith community? The purpose of a faith community is to help and aid those that need a safe place, that need that security. All of us stand convicted in our lives for one thing or another. It may not have been unintentional murder or manslaughter, in this case, is what we call it in our society. But all of us stand in need of support and help from each other. To change the words of Descartes, I am because we are. I am because we are. My identity, my security comes from my attachment that I have to others, specifically to you. You are the reason I am. You are the reason I'm here. You are the reason I exist. I am because we are. Our congregation is to be a safe place. Unfortunately, there was a time in the past, since I've been here, that someone actually left our congregation, that they had affiliated with us for quite some time. And they sent me an email and said, I cannot continue to affiliate with Baruch Haba because I, and this was their exact quote, I need a safe place to be, to come and to join a community. And the way things have been lately, Baruch Haba is not a safe place anymore. To give a little background, there had been some gossip regarding this person. There had been some antagonism and between a couple individuals. The person no longer felt safe in our community, and I was heartbroken because we are to be like a city of refuge. We are to let the righteous run in and be safe. We are to be a depiction of that strong tower that the Lord is. We are to represent Him. We are to be a model of that strong tower where the people can run in and be safe in Him. So not only are we construction workers that build the road, that lead to the city of refuge, that put up the sign saying, security ahead. I know where to go to find hope. I know the road that you can take to find peace and wholeness in your life. I know the place. Let me help make the road smooth. Let me help remove the obstacles from your path so that you can find security and refuge in the crime, the guilt, the burden that you are carrying in your life. Let us build the road. Not only are we those road builders, but we are also the operators. We are the assembly of that city of refuge, that place where people can come and find rest and hope. There is one other thing that to me is incredibly exciting about the cities of refuge. We're told that if the person was found to have honestly killed the person, accidentally, unaware, and without previous malice or hatred, they could come to the city and live. In other words, they could have a home. They could have occupations. I like to think, since these cities were actually, the general population were actually Levites, they could come there and they were a support to the Levites. They were a blessing to the Levites. I also like to think of it the other way around. Not only were they to come and could have a job and a place to live and an income and a livelihood, they could bring their family with them, we're told, and they could support the Levitical city there. But the other way around is also encouraging to me. That is that the Levites would be a support to them. Because anyone, we're told in Scripture, that sheds innocent blood carries guilt. Genesis chapter 9, verse 6 talks about any death that occurs, any blood that is shed carries a certain measure of guilt. Even if it didn't happen with intent and malice, there is still guilt that these individuals carried in their heart. Even if the death was unaware, even if it was unintended, they need support from the Levites in these cities. I think it's beautiful that this is the reason they go to a Levitical city. It's not just that they go to some spot. It's not just base. It's a Levitical city where they could receive instruction, encouragement, healing, hope, peace, and restoration in their life. What a beautiful thing that the Levites were there when they came running up to the gate and they give their story to the elders of the city. The elders of the city could bring them in and support them and help them. We're told that they gave them a place to stay. How beautiful. They would stay there. Did you notice this in the text? They would stay there until the death of the high priest. When the high priest at that time would die, they could then go free. And to me, this is both perplexing and really beautiful at the same time. Why was it that the death of the high priest would mean that they could then leave the city of refuge and be free? Imagine this. Because the avenger of blood would be able to, otherwise, if they ever left the city of refuge, they could potentially be captured and caught by the avenger. But when the high priest died, the avenger was no longer allowed to pursue them. Now, the death of the high priest substituted, made appeasement for the avenger, for the family that had lost a loved one, for that person that had inadvertently been killed. The death of the high priest proved as a substitute for the family that needed appeasement, that needed vengeance. It's interesting that not only was the perpetrator cared for in the city of refuge, but there was a way that God provided for the family of the deceased to find comfort and healing. That comfort and healing came through the death of the high priest. Who was the head of the Levites? Who was the person in charge over all the Levitical cities? The high priest. And so when the head of all those Levitical cities died, it would bring release, freedom, appeasement, satisfaction to the families that had lost a loved one. And this is where it gets really beautiful, because even in rabbinic tradition, the death of the high priest in this situation is seen as a sort of atonement. It is a substitutionary death for the perpetrator, the manslaughterer. The death of the high priest, even in rabbinic tradition, is seen as an atonement, a covering that is made for the family. The amazing part is this. Who is our high priest? As believers, Yeshua is our high priest. Yeshua is our high priest that has died so that there can be appeasement, satisfaction, and release to the hurts that have sprung up in our lives. Picture this. You and I are guilty of attacking others, of wounding others. Hopefully none of you have ever been guilty of manslaughter. But we damage, we wound, we hurt each other. And we've all done this. And we have all experienced it the other way, where we have been wounded and inflicted, damaged by the words and actions of others. There's the opportunity that we have to run to the city of refuge to be safe. So here you run to Baruch Haba, a safe place, I hope. But we have an incredible message for you. The high priest has already died. The high priest that would bring release and freedom to the guilt and what is owed you, or is owed to the family, or to the victims of those that have been wounded, the satisfaction has already been paid. The high priest has already died. The solution has already been established. Yeshua the high priest has died to bring release to those that are living exiled in a city of refuge. And indeed, what is the greatest rift that exists? I posit that the greatest rift that exists is not even between you and your coworker, or you and your next-door neighbor, or you and that family member, sibling, or parent. I posit that the greatest rift that exists is between us and the Most High. The separation that has been established because we have hurt Him. We have inflicted pain, anguish, suffering on His heart because of our actions. In that case, we're the perpetrator, He's the victim. But once again, let me encourage you to recognize the high priest has died. Yeshua has made a sacrifice so that there can be reconciliation. Let me encourage you to understand that there can be reconciliation between you and those that are in conflict with you. There can be reconciliation between you and those that have hurt you. Perhaps it's you that have hurt someone else. There can be reconciliation. Why? The high priest has already died. There can be reconciliation between you and the Most High. There can be reconciliation and appeasement and relationship between you and God. That relationship can be restored. Why? The high priest has already died. Isn't this beautiful? In Joshua chapter 20 and 21, we see the message of the good news. We see the message of a high priest whose death serves as an atonement for those that whose lives need restoration, for those relationships that need restored. Yes, we are a city of refuge, but as soon as people arrive, they need to know and understand the hope of one that has carried the responsibility and the guilt. The high priest died for the sake of all those who lived, who were exiled to the city of refuge. So the Most High has died to bring freedom to us who have been exiled in our lives. The amazing thing is, it's already happened. There is no more high priest. Yeshua is the only remaining high priest in the entire system of Jewish tradition. And the current high priest has already died to bring release for us. So why do we need to be unreconciled to those that we bicker and fight with and have disagreements? As long as we continue to fight and be obstinate, it's as if we're pretending that Yeshua didn't die. As long as we are obstinate against God, we're acting as if the high priest hasn't died. I encourage you in your life this week to live in such a way as to understand that the high priest has died. What does that mean practically in Joshua 20 and 21? That means you're free from the city of refuge. Those broken relationships that caused you to flee can now be mended. Yeshua has carried the burden. Yeshua has carried the pain. Yeshua has carried the offense. Yeshua makes it possible for reconciliation.